are listening to Matrix FM and we're talking to Nikki Hager. Nikki is a researcher, journalist for the Sunday Star Times and author of such books as Seeds of Distrust, that's about how governments work, and Secret Power, on US intelligence networks and New Zealand's part in them. He is here to talk about how people, anyone, can get involved in political action and make real change. Thanks for being here, Nikki.
What I'd like to talk about is really to talk to people who, like all of us, are political animals but feel cut out of politics or feel like there's no place for them in it, and why that might be and what to do about it. And right now, the time where I'm talking is just shortly after the national elections, which, as listeners will know, did not fill many people with excitement or hopefulness or thrills or fizzing with, you know, expectations. If we were people coming from China or Eastern Europe, we'd think that the idea of having a vote was a fantastic thing. Whereas actually in New Zealand, people feel pissed off at the politicians. They feel kind of manipulated. People get really tired of being treated as a potential bit of opinion poll percentage point to be manipulated up or down. And most people I've come across, in fact, everybody I've come across was found the election a disappointing experience, which they wanted to be passed them as quickly as possible. And so what I'm interested in is why it is that people get so alienated from politics and what they can do about it. Because like I said, we're very political animals. People, once they get out of that world of politicians, really care about what's happening. They care about what's happening down the street. They care about what's happening to the world. They actually have instincts of being concerned about other people. So why is it that when it is called politics and it's made up of these ghastly self-seeking kind of politicians, do people switch off and think that maybe politics is not the place for them? Now, I'd start by saying I actually think that for many people, being turned off politics is a pretty rational reaction. If you look at election time, which is like the most exaggerated form of bad politics, politicians are campaigning not on what they intend to do, but on whatever their marketing PR people have told them they might be able to manipulate and get the most votes from. And so, for example, in this recent election, you had the National Party with a leader, Don Brash, who's interested in issues like privatisation and deregulation and banking policy and economics. And he was running an election on issues like race policy, which he knows nothing about and doesn't care about. And doesn't believe in the things he was saying. He's a liberal deep down who actually isn't into Maori bashing. But he was being advised by his cunning overseas advisors, the same firm, by the way, which advised John Howard in Australia to do the throwing babies off boats stunt, and was advising the British Conservatives in their recent election against Labour to use racism in that country. And so they play these games because they think they might get some percentage points out of it. And what does a person feel when they're at the end of that kind of campaign? They feel kind of dirty by it, and they don't want to have anything to do with it. On the other side, the Labour Party, the other possible government, were running this incredibly boring, bloodless, no-vision campaign of being good at running the economy. And so where does it go when you want to have people talking about what's wrong with society? Why aren't more people happy with what's going on? How come young people can't buy a house these days because everyone says it's such a great thing to have house prices go up so you can't afford one anymore? Who's talking about the issues that matter to people? Well, no one really was. And so it starts to feel like it's not your election. It's the politician's election. And that kind of politics diffuses through the rest of the 3 years in between elections, where governments, once they have secured your vote, act like an elected dictatorship. And the normal way of making a decision, again, this is, I'm trying to explain why I think people rationally feel cut out of politics and give up on it. In between elections, once they're elected, once they have acted humble and interested and listened to the people and got their votes, they act like an elected dictatorship, whether they're on a the Labour Party side or the National Party side or some combination of a coalition. How do they make a decision? They don't say to the public, we're wondering what to do about transport. What do you think about it? Never, ever. No, what will happen will be that there will be lobbying from the roading industry and lobbying from local authorities and negotiations between parties and pressures within the public service. And the ministers might work on policy for months or even years. And then the first that the public will hear about it, after it's been kept carefully secret right through all those processes, will be when the announcements are made of the decision. And at that stage, they might call for submissions under something, that most cynical thing called consultation. But consultation, as anyone who's ever written a petition submission for their local council or for the government knows, while sometimes worthwhile in the context of a big campaign, is often a very futile, actually really mean activity to do to people, because they're not going to get listened to by that stage of the process most often. And so in that way, and also in the participants in politics who you feel have the power. And the classic case of this is when an item comes up on the news and you hear that the government's announced a particular policy and you hear who's commenting on it, and you hear business lobby groups, you might hear the unions sometimes, you'll hear the BNZ bank economist who's a paid lobbyist and spokesperson for the finance industry to say what's best for overseas-owned banks, not what's best for New Zealanders. And all these people will have their say in the media, but actually ordinary people, maybe what we would think about it, you never hear it. The example I gave before, about once a week, once every 2 weeks, you'll have a news item about house prices rising. Now, house prices rising has to be one of the major social disasters in New Zealand. Now, of course, it's not a social disaster if you're 55 and you own a house and it's nearly paid off. But if you're 20 or 30, the constant house price rises, another 15% this year, and in some parts of the country I heard this morning, 25%, means that you're never going to be able to buy a house in the middle of a city like somebody 20 years older than you could do. It's actually a terrible social re-engineering of our city's disaster. But because of lobby groups and because the spokespeople will be from the real estate industry and from the banking industry, and then some dumb journalists and politicians who haven't thought about it and they've listened to the public relations spin coming from those other ones, it's called good news every time house prices go up, whereas most people in the country will be thinking this is really, really bad news because I was having trouble saving for a house, now and it's even more trouble. And so what you find is the accumulated effect, I'm giving just one example, is that when people listen to the news, they're hearing a whole lot of paid voices. They're paying the voices of hearing the voices of people who are representing big lobbies. And often they're not just hearing the voices, but behind that, there's a general sense that there's PR campaigns and lobbying and strategy, which they never see. But I think most intelligent people, and most people are intelligent, when they hear the news, they have this sense, they can smell it. They have a sense that they're not getting the whole story, or that when something's called good news, there's probably some side to it that they haven't heard. And when something's called bad news, probably some people are doing very well from it. And that generally there's more to any story that they hear than is actually being presented to them. In other words, coming back to where I started, I think it's a very rational thing when people think that politics leaves them out, when that they actually get a kind of a discouraged or hopeless feeling when they think about politics, because rationally, on many issues day by day in this country, an ordinary person, an ordinary young person or an ordinary old person, doesn't feel very involved. And there's an interesting thing. Lots of people say they feel kind of cynical about politics, and you know, politicians are jerks, and of course they lie. And I reckon that cynicism, which a lot of people adopt, is actually another way of saying kind of disillusionment. And actually, it's another way of saying disappointment, because we are political animals. We care heaps about those policies which affect our lives, and we care about how our country acts over Iraq and what our country's doing about global warming or whatever it is. And when you think you can do nothing about it, even though you're a political animal, you put on the defense. And your defense, I think, is this thing called cynicism. And so the next thing I want to talk about soon is what we do about that, because how we actually become the political animals we want to be.
Many people obviously do care about politics and how it affects them and their world, but feel they have no chance of making a difference or their lives are too busy. What can they practically do?
Yeah, well, so far I've been talking about the bad news. I wanted now to talk about the good news, because I living here in Wellington and living in a political world, ever since I left school, ever since a few months after I left school as a 17-year-old, I've been wrapped up in politics. And so I'm surrounded by, and my life has consisted of, a whole lot of stories of people who have been involved in politics in incredibly effective ways. Not always, but often in effective ways. And so that's what I want to talk about the rest of the time, because while there's a lot of disappointing and discouraging pressures, and there are probably people who would see that, in fact, I know there are people who see it as their job to figure out ways to exclude people from politics because it doesn't suit their client to have all those rowdy people involved in politics. A classic case is the genetic engineering lobby, which put an immense amount of effort into trying to alienate, insult, and discourage the GE movement, anti-GE movement. When all that's going on, you know, people could think there's no space for them. So I want to talk about the fantastic things that people do where they have learnt their power and discovered that that political part of themselves can be expressed. In fact, it can be one of the most rewarding parts of life. So that's where I want to go now. And I'll start with some examples. And the first example I want to start with will be a bit of a surprising example, maybe to some people, because I'll start with the genetic engineering example. Because I think there's probably quite a lot of people who think in New Zealand that there were all those people who campaigned on genetic engineering, and there were marches and protests and huge numbers of submissions, and there were all these different groups, women's groups and scientist groups and all sorts, campaigned on that issue for a few years recently. And I think a lot of people think they lost. And that actually, one of the things I really dislike the Labour government for is that they made people feel like they lost, but they didn't lose. The anti-GE campaign in New Zealand, as part of a campaign around the world, but particularly New Zealand, is one of the most successful campaigns for years and years. And I'll explain why. People think, what went on back then, for those who weren't paying much attention, is that the fight came down to a question of whether or not New Zealand kept a moratorium on genetically engineered plants and animals in our fields and agriculture and science, whether there were going to be genetically engineered things walking around or growing in our countryside. And the government, after a long and really fierce debate, took that moratorium off, which was a really, really crummy thing for them to do, because actually one of the jobs of a government should be to honour all that public feeling. And if the opinion polls are saying that 70 or 80% of people don't want the moratorium to come off, and hundreds or thousands of people have put their hearts and souls into it, a democratic government should reward them and make them feel good about their efforts. In fact, they kind of got stomped on a bit. But the actual story, the real story of the genetic engineering campaign, is that a few years later, New Zealand has no genetically engineered plants in any fields and no genetically engineered animals. We have no companies that want to use genetically engineered products in their foods. We have supermarket chains which refuse to have a single genetic engineered thing on their shelves. In fact, New Zealand is as GE-free as we could possibly hope it would be at the moment. 99.99% or something. A huge percentage in a world which is awash with genetically engineered products from the United States and Latin American countries and all around the place. New Zealand is holding the line admirably, more than nearly anywhere. And the reason we are is 100% because of that fantastic campaign that all those people ran. The government, in its nasty, antisocial way, said they were taking off the moratorium and that the campaign had lost, but they knew where the public was. The fact was that those campaigners and all those people who signed petitions and stuck stickers up and marched and the rest of it, they won. There are no companies that want to have genetic engineering in New Zealand because they know the public doesn't want it. The government's too scared to approve it in the fields as you get in other countries. The science, although there's talk about it, it's happening very slowly and still being very restricted. And so the fact is that the first example I want to give of people who really won in this country over a campaign are those anti-GE campaigners, that every person who was part of that has, in practice, kept this country as GE-free, as any more GE-free than any other country in the world. It was a huge achievement, and when the first really gross catastrophes of genetic engineering start to show in the years ahead, people will look back and realize what an amazing thing they did here. Now that's just the first example. Let me give some other examples, because, and then I want to talk about why those people have succeeded while other people haven't, because there's some really interesting lessons in what it takes to be able to change the world and to discover that funny riff-raff of people called the public actually can beat the lobbyists and the specialist lawyers and the industry groups and the cynical politicians and the rest of it. I want to talk about it next, but let's just give some more examples. A few years ago, New Zealand had a very strong lobby for continuing the most crazy of things in the modern age, which was the logging of rainforests in New Zealand. Now, you would think that after decades of debate and New Zealand being a clean, green place where people fly around the world in their millions to come and look at the scenery, that would have been completely off the record, off the scale here, to still be logging our forests, which have rare kiwis and birds in them and stuff. But actually, it was going as fast as they possibly could on the West Coast, which is the main place where there are those kind of forests left. And in 1997, several years ago now, a group of people, mainly from one student environment group, the Victoria University of Wellington environment group, focused on that issue, and they went down and started a occupation of the forest. Now, as we all know, one protest does not change the world. But what it did was, it was one of those great protests which communicates to people. It was a nice, normal people living in the forest, getting arrested, sometimes getting beaten up, having all sorts of hassles living in the bush, but about a floating number between 20 and 30 and 40 of them lived down there. First of all, they thought, we weren't sure whether it would be for 1 week or 2 weeks when they went. It actually ended up being month after month after month. But what that protest did is, what actually protests are for, which is it told the whole of the rest of the country that something was going on they didn't even know about, which was that our country still chopped down forests. And having raised that awareness, other people got into the campaign and did other things, which political people can do. There were scientists and academics who started explaining what was wrong with it and about the ecology. There were researchers who found out how much the logging was going on and whether there were alternatives for the communities down there. There were people, many of them from that same student environment group, and then their friends and people who jumped onto the train around the country, who spoke in the news and articulated the view. So for once, it wasn't just, you know, the merchant bank economist and this politician versus that politician, but there were these other voices who were explaining why that just didn't belong in New Zealand anymore. And then there were people who made it their job, and this is another part of politics, which is one of the most rewarding bits, that once they'd told people there was this big issue going on, and they'd made them think it was a big issue by sticking posters on lampposts in Wellington, a new poster every 2 or 3 weeks, so it looked like it was really going on, because they were bothering to do that, they started finding ways that other people could show that they supported the campaign as well. And that meant that for weeks at a time, down in central Wellington, there were letter writing stalls where someone could walk up and they'd see the banner of the forest campaign, and they'd write a letter off to the Prime Minister, who was Jenny Shipley in those days. That's a blast from the past. Oh, how we love them in retrospect. Or send it off to the Minister of Forestry. And hundreds and thousands of people around the country, by the efforts of those campaigners, came to feel part of that campaign as well, and went to meetings and learnt about it and received the publications and went on marches. And the accumulated effect of that from the beginning of 1997, that's 97, and then 98, and then into 1999, so that's 3 years of work for some of those people. When we approached the election of 1999, the campaign had grown to a point that when the Labour government was thinking, Labour Party was thinking, how could we win this election and become government? They thought, we know what's a really popular issue. We'll say that we'll stop all the logging in the country, and they did. And now if you go down the West Coast, places that were the names which those people publicised where there were magnificent forests, as I say, with kiwis and white herons and beautiful rivers and lagoons and canyons that had chainsaws going from day till night. Every one of those areas is now part of a national park or ecological reserves, and they've got signs going to them and tourists and new bridges and leaflets about where you can walk in them. And so those people, there were originally about 10 of them in the Victoria University Environment Group, and then because they were being successful and because they were looking like they were going places, other people helped them, and because they spoke to the public through the news and showed that they really cared through the protests, and then got out on the streets and gave people ways to show that they, not just so people felt inside themselves felt it, but gave them ways to participate by writing letters or wearing badges or joining in the marches and the protests, they completely turned around that issue in New Zealand, which otherwise had this long, powerful, corrosive lobby group, which was the indigenous logging industry, which would have kept down chopping down trees for decades to come left to itself. So that's another positive example. New Zealand's nuclear-free policy, at one time, that was completely inconceivable. That was the one that I grew up on when I first left school. When that one began, it seemed like wacky, weirdo, lefty, impossible stuff that New Zealand would be able to get the world's biggest superpower to keep its nuclear weapons out of New Zealand. And by a series of campaign after campaign after campaign, over a number of years, eventually the Labour Party, when it became government, couldn't resist the policy and accepted it. And the miraculous thing was that 6 years after that, the National Party, which had been fervent supporters and promoters of the American alliance, adopted a nuclear-free policy as well, because they saw that the public would never be on their side while they went against it. Now, the common theme, and what happened in these campaigns, and that's what I'm really coming to, there's some themes in this. The people who were in these campaigns used some tools, and they believed in it, and they were persistent. But there's an interesting phenomenon that goes on, and I've watched these campaigns, and I know what happens. For a while, there are often those first 10 people, or that first group of friends who start off a political campaign. But what happens is there's a barrier they have to overcome. They put up their posters, they organise their meetings, it feels small, they keep their protest going in the forest for longer, they speak on the radio more often, they put out more press releases and reports. And what they're overcoming is that thing I talked about in the first place, that thing that stops other people getting involved, and that is that people don't really believe it will work. They don't really believe that a little group of people who are sitting up trees or speaking on the radio will ever be able to stop it. And there's an interesting thing that happens in successful public democratic campaigns, and that is that after a while, if the people have the right energy and work vigorously enough and inspire people and talk to the rest of their citizens rather than just looking like weirdo protesters, I don't know what they're on about, if people run a good campaign, then bit by bit they kind of thaw out people's sense of hopelessness and powerlessness. And that's when campaigns work. That's why we don't have fields of genetically engineered corn and other things in New Zealand now. And that's why there aren't any nuclear ships and nuclear weapons in New Zealand. That's why there's no logging on our public forests anymore. And the reason is that after a while, this amazing chemistry happens, which I've watched as an observer of these things many, many times. And that is that people start to get hope. They start to think, maybe these people are going to win. Maybe they actually can change it. I do care about this too. Maybe I can do something too. And you see this thawing going on where it goes from thinking, oh yeah, they're protesters, protesters protest, that's just funny sort of people, that's what they do. And then it moves until you reach a stage, this is on a successful campaign, on one where the people have been vigorous and they speak well and they've bothered to do their research, where more and more people get involved. And the reason they get involved is that they pick up the hopefulness too. And they start to believe they can make a difference. And the political part of them, because they're political animals, starts to think that they have an opportunity for actually expressing that and being a political person, which we all are. And so what happens is that a campaign which starts small and where the people who've been running it have to push all the energy in themselves, it suddenly starts to roll on its own. And they suddenly start to get phone calls from people in other towns saying, can we do that same thing here? Would you like to come and give us a talk? And could we get some of your posters here? And I've been trying to track you down for ages. How do I get involved in this? And there's a strange magic that happens at that point in the political campaign where the sense of hopelessness that people have, that disappointment that they can't make a difference, is broken through by the sight of people who are making a difference and are enjoying it, or at least look like they're enjoying it and are, seem to be getting somewhere. And at that point, that strange chemistry happens. And when a campaign reaches that stage, normally, in some way or other, it's going to win, because when the public moves, suddenly the lobby groups don't look so powerful. It's when people are discouraged and stay at home and don't do anything that the lobby groups are going to win. But when people reach that point of being involved and feeling it's their campaign and participating in large numbers, most issues that I've ever watched or been involved in like that, the people actually succeed. It works. And so if I was to say the opposite to that story I told at the beginning, which is those discouraging forces which really do exist and which make it rational for people to feel pushed out of and irrelevant in politics, I say the great thing about New Zealand, funny little small town New Zealand, is that it's a scale of a place. It's a sort of place where when that group of people do get active, the GE Free campaigners or the Free Zowie from prison campaigners or whoever they are, when people really vigorously try and they work together and they find people who they like to work with to do it, over and over they succeed, which is why New Zealand is a healthier, less rapidly kind of redneck country than lots of places. That's the side of New Zealand we can be really proud of, because all those people have done that and it's really worked.
It seems that many protests could do more to appeal to average New Zealanders, because by getting middle New Zealand interested and turning up on their marches would send a stronger message to the ruling class, i.e. local and national government. I'm thinking of one of the anti-motorway marches in Wellington that I participated in, which had a no-show from anyone outside the core activist group. Now, this group, they did a great job and were highly motivated, but no real broad public support was apparent. Appearances unfortunately do matter, so perhaps they would have greater success if they focused on their own PR and inspiring people who care but wouldn't normally get involved to actually get involved.
Yes, I have to say I agree with you, and I'll put it in the framework that I see it, which is what I've been talking about. First of all, to say, of course the public doesn't win every time, and we don't always win completely, and we don't always win straight away. And the motorway is going to be, the Wellington motorway is going to be a monument to stupidity, which is going to be very disappointing to have to witness.
Yeah.
But what I would say, and this is where I haven't been part of all those motorway things and I haven't seen all the people, and I think there's been some fine people there who have done some good things, but one of the problems is I would say that there are different views of the role of a protester in society. Should we put it that way? Let's put it in a big and lofty way. There are some people who, by the way that they dress and talk and things, feel like they look like, to me, like they feel like they're representing themselves and their mates, and that, you know, we might be the only ones who think this, but we, you know, we're going to march all 20 of us down the street and have our say on this. My view's always been that if you go out into the world of politics, you're not just representing yourself. In fact, the most powerful thing you can do is when you represent heaps of other people. That you and by that I mean you don't claim them on your side, insincerely, but where you actually genuinely try to give them a voice. And what you want is the ideal place, the thing that scares politicians and makes them start to worry about a campaign, is not when 20 people march down the street looking to your average friendly suburban person. So my gauge of this is kind of like my parents' neighbours, and, you know, people like that who are way away from the world of politics, but they're good, decent, valued people. If there are 30 people who walk down the street, or 20 people who walk down the street, and those people think, whoa, they look really weird, or if they just hear, blah, 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 angry protester, then that's when the politicians and the roading companies think, no problem there. I don't think they're really going to rouse the public up against us. What you want is, and what I believe the role of a democratic organizer is that your parents, neighbors, and that nice person across the street, and people who are getting their children's lunch ready in the morning when they hear the radio, and all the rest of them, when they see it, they think, yes, I probably wouldn't go and do that myself, but those nice young people, I really do think they're doing a good thing. And the thing about it is that when politicians know that the people out in suburban land and family land and real life of New Zealand are hearing the voices on the radio and thinking that, then they've got a political problem that they can't ignore. And when the people keep doing that and they're persistent, because you don't win overnight against all the forces of darkness which are trying to get their way for commercial reasons. But when people speak in a way where they're actually speaking for the values and the concerns of ordinary people, and they do it in a persistent way, that's when it can really have an effect.
We've been talking to Nicky Hager, a New Zealand researcher, journalist and author, about how people can get involved in political action and make real change. You've been listening to Matrix 107.5 FM. Thanks for listening.